This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. This is, of course, the show trainers listen to, and we are happy to have you with us on this Wednesday afternoon. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, along with retired top trainer, the Pontiff of the Pick Four, Jude Feld, in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and welcoming everybody tuning in throughout North America on Sirius 219 XM Channel 206, and all of you tuning in worldwide with our live streaming on your computer or mobile device at horseracingradio.net. Really excited for this program here tonight. A little bit of a different twist to Trainer Talk. Now, this will be a very first in the history of the show. Jude, we typically spend time visiting with trainers, talking about their life and their career and their background and how they got started in the game. We have never had a trainer on Trainer Talk twice until today.
Well, it's absolutely necessary. The guy wins races in bunches, and you can't possibly talk to Todd Pletcher without, updating the program, so to speak. What he's done in 4 years takes most people a lifetime.
Yeah, well, let's put it this way. Todd first joined us on Trainer Talk on December 12th, 2012. At that time, Todd's win total was just over 3,100. Since that show, Todd has saddled more than 1,100 additional winners, and his career total now stands at 4,224 career victories. Also in that time, he's been honored with two additional Eclipse Awards as the nation's outstanding trainer. So, Todd Pletcher, there is plenty to talk about with him over the course of the next little bit here for you on Trainer Talk tonight. Todd, thanks for taking the time again, my friend, and welcome back.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, making a little history here as the first trainer to repeat on Trainer Talk.
Nice. I didn't know that. That's certainly an accomplishment to be proud of.
Well, it is. Let's start for just a second by recapping some of the things that we brought up in the first program, and then we're going to spend some time looking at some of the notable horses, and there's so many, but some of the notable horses that you've been fortunate to be around in your career, because we really didn't get an opportunity to focus on any of the horses in that first show, but you were kind of born into the business. You started being around the game with your dad, JJ, who was training horses. You worked with other trainers as well, including D-Wayne Lucas and Charlie Whittingham, and then went out on your own in 1996. Would you ever imagine that you'd be sitting here today with more than 4,200 victories to your credit and being a seven-time Eclipse Award winner?
No, absolutely not. And I was kind of reflecting or talking about it with someone the other day, when I left, decided to make the move after working almost 7 years for Wayne Lucas, would have been after the Breeders' Cup in 1995 when I made the decision to go ahead and give it a try on my own. It was a very intimidating situation. Essentially, you're leaving arguably the best assistant trainer job there is in the country and working with a barn full of the best horses in the world, and coming off Classic wins and Breeders' Cup competitors, and just, Wayne was really, really loaded at the time. And so, kind of leaving that. And I think when I first set up shop at Hialeah in December of 95, we had seven horses. I think four of them were owned at least in partnership by my dad, and none of them had won a race. So sort of leaving, the world's most successful thoroughbred trainer to do that on your own with essentially horses that were all maidens, it was very intimidating, and there were certainly some times along the way where I wasn't sure I made the right decision, but ultimately you just gotta someday feel like you're ready and do your thing and see what happens.
Do you feel like you've made the right decision now?
Hopefully. Not always. I don't think that every day.
You know, Wayne joined us on this program last summer at Saratoga, and he was talking about you and Kieran and Dallas and Mike Maker and George Weaver and the training tree that he has produced with successful trainers that are out there today. And he said they were. He felt like they were all going to be good without him. Do you agree with that?
Well, you know, I think ultimately, yes, I agree with that. But I would also say that we all got to where we were a lot sooner, a lot faster, a lot more effectively, and because of his influence and because of what we learned, not only from him, but Jeff Lucas was a huge part of the organization when all of us guys that you mentioned were there. And I think there's certain things that sometimes takes you a lot longer to learn than when you're put into an environment like that, where, you know, there's so much success and so many things to learn from. And, you know, and guys like Wayne have seen, and from their experience can pass along to you that might take you years to learn without being in that type of environment. So I think ultimately probably, you know, everyone's going to go on and be successful. Whether, you know, if you're Roy Williams, you're probably going to be a successful basketball coach, whether you went to North Carolina and worked under Dean Smith or not. But sure as heck doesn't hurt to be around those type of guys and what you can learn from them. And you can do it sometimes so much more quickly than you can when you're trying to sort through it on your own.
You had such a leg up because your father's such a great horseman. But the Lucas team, the Lucas devotees, however you want to call them, you guys have the same way of running a barn as Wayne. Wayne has such a great organization. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, I mean, it sounds so simple, but, you know, Wayne's philosophy was that attention to detail matters. And, you know, some people might say, well, why does having the plaque hung correctly on the stall door really matter to horse winning? And, you know, ultimately it might not, but hopefully that attention to detail to the little things carries over in every other aspect of the operation. And, you know, and the groom takes a little more pride in taking care of his horse. So it's sort of that trickle down philosophy that, if you try to do every single little thing right, that it carries over to the bigger picture. And, you know, some people take a bigger picture approach, but, you know, I think that attention to detail that, you know, you try to uncover every stone and make sure you cross every T and dot every I. And, you know, if you do it consistently over an extended period of time, it's maybe that little bit of difference that's gonna help you, you know, maybe win that photo by a nose.
The other thing that Wayne brought up, Todd, was that he looks at himself, you know, of course, being a former basketball coach, as somewhat of a recruiter. And when he had a chance to sit down with you and Kieran and Dallas and everybody for the interview process before he brought you on board, he talked about that whole stepping stone and that whole process that he goes through when he's looking at prospective new help for his barn. What do you remember about sitting down with Wayne for that interview that first day?
Well, actually, so I spent one summer during college. I guess it would have been in between my sophomore and junior year of college, working for Wayne grooming horses at Arlington Park in Chicago, and Randy Bradshaw was the assistant there. So, you know, I learned a little bit about how the organization works, and you know, just basically jumped in and spent the summer working, which was a great learning experience and that sort of thing. But then the following summer, I did the same thing working for Charlie Whittingham. But as I was doing that, I was also keeping in touch with Wayne as a potential, hopefully going to work for him after I graduated from college. And I flew out to California. I was going to the University of Arizona in Tucson, so I flew to California and visited Wayne at Santa Anita. And I just remember talking to him, and he said, you know, that he'd have a position for me, but he wasn't sure where it would be. And he asked me what the time frame was. And I said, you know, I'll be ready to work as soon as I graduate from college. And so I remember calling him back and saying, you know, that I got my degree and finished and ready to go. And he said, drive to or go to New York and meet Jeff there and start to work. So that's what I did. And, you know, it was a pretty straightforward process, really. I think, you know, he kind of had known me, and I'm sure he asked Randy if I was okay and reliable and those sort of things from the summer I spent in Chicago. And was fortunate enough that my dad and he trained quarter horses at the same time, and so he kind of knew my dad for many, many years prior to that. So I had a pretty good in before, you know, I actually ever showed up.
Yeah, it's always great when you can bypass the interview process.
Yeah. You know, the other thing, if you remember, Jude, that Wayne brought up in that interview was talking about how for the first 6 months or so, his operation with the new people that come into his barn to work is, he referred to it as like boot camp. He said, it's like being in the military. And he said, we really bear down hard on these individuals and we want them to be successful. And Todd, he said that if you can make it through the first 6 months, then you're well on your way to being successful. First of all, was it that intense when you stepped into place with Wayne? And secondly, does that help? And do you run your operation like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's similarities and there's no question it helps. I mean, I honestly remember, I mean, you got to keep in mind that, you know, I was a college student for 4 years prior to that. So the hours that I was were quite a bit different than the hours that the Wayne Lucas organization was. So I actually remember, yeah, just being physically tired, you know, for a while. I mean, your body clock is in for a big adjustment when you start there. And you're getting up at 3:30 every morning, and pretty much at that time, Belmont was racing 6 days a week. Saratoga was racing 6 days a week. And I mean, you go from 3:30 in the morning and sometimes get home at 7:30, 8 o'clock at night and right back at it the next day. And so, I mean, it takes you a little while just to physically get adjusted to that schedule and that lifestyle. So, yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it, but it's, you know, I think it instills that work ethic that, you know, that you need. And, you know, when horses are in need of your care every day, and unfortunately everything can change overnight. So, you know, you can't miss anything. And, but I definitely remember that part of it, just being physically wiped out by the end of the day most of the time.
Having been stabled near Wayne a couple of times and watching his operation and then watching you train in the morning and being around your barn a few times, it seems like the tension and pressure was ratcheted up at Wayne's barn, whereas yours is maybe a little bit more zen. Do you find it that way?
I think so. I mean, everyone has their own personality on how they do things. And, you know, Wayne sometimes be a little more intense. And I think you can't really manufacture your own personality. You just kind of got to let what you do, what works for you. And I've never really feel good about yelling at people or telling, you know, getting upset. I don't really feel like it changes things. Sometimes it just creates more mistakes. But you know, some guys can motivate people by wanting to jump on them a little bit and get in their face a little bit. And that's not my style. So I find that, you know, a little different leadership from my standpoint, keeping things sometimes focused, but not too tense. And I think everyone can kind of do a better job. But I think what you find is that, you know, the really good people don't need a lot of motivation. You know, if you gotta tell someone, hey man, I need you to do a good job today, then you probably got the wrong guy there.
Visiting with trainer Todd Pletcher on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Todd, I mentioned we were going to focus on some of the horses that you've had the privilege to be around, and so many good ones counted among that list. We're going to try and take a look at as many as we can. But one thing I want to go back to is something that you brought up to us in that first interview back in 2012, when you said that you've maybe the most excited you've ever been after a race was following the 2007 Belmont, when Rags to Riches outdueled Curlin, giving you your first classic winner. Is that still the case, or has any horse come along since then and maybe topped that feeling?
you know, I'm one of those guys. I get excited and enjoy winning any race. You know, maiden 12.5 sometimes very gratifying. But no, I mean, I think just from in terms of I don't know if excitement would be the right word, but I mean, the race itself, just it was. There's so many emotions during the course of the race. First of all, making the decision to run her in the Belmont, you know, is something that we really thought about a lot and wanted to make sure we were doing the right thing. And it was a very deep crop of 3-year-old colt that year with Curlin and Hardspun and Street Sense. And so we were sort of, you know, thinking that over and wanting to make sure we were doing the right thing with a filly that was a bona fide superstar, and you don't want to make a mistake. But she's also bred top and bottom for the Belmont. And so when Street Sense decided not to go in the Belmont, we decided that was sort of the crack in the door that we were looking for to go ahead and take a shot. And then when she fell on her head leaving the gate, I just, you know, I thought to myself, you know, here we've agonized for almost 5 weeks over if we're doing the right thing or not. And basically just went out the window right there. And then when she was able to recover and put herself back in a position and then turning for home, head and head with Curlin, looked like she was going to win, and it looked like he was going to come back. And it was just, you know, a great stretch duel that looked like it could go either way a couple of times. It's amazing that in less than 2.5 minutes, so many emotions can go through your mind. But I think just all of that sort of built up, and it was our first classic win. And then, you know, Philly doing it for the first time in 100+ years, it was, yeah, I mean, if you can't get excited about that, then what would you get excited for?
Yeah, it was a phenomenal race, and one that I'll never forget. I mean, it's one of my favorites. When people ask me, what are some of the best races you've ever seen? I think that ranks right up there on my list, and I've seen a lot of races. So.
Yeah, no, I mean, it does. And, you know, to be honest with you, I think part of it was probably because Zenyatta and Rachel Alexander came on right after that. But sometimes I think it gets overlooked a little bit how great she was, Rags to Riches was, and how big of a win that was. When you think that Curlin went on to be 2-time horse of the year, I mean, that was, it wasn't like she kind of backed into a Belmont. I mean, she beat, you know, a world-class all-time, you know, I don't know where he'd rank all-time top horses, but he's pretty far up there. So, I think sometimes it gets lost in the shuffle a little bit because of the accomplishments of the other two fillies, but I think she was arguably as good as any of them. Her career didn't last quite as long as some of the other ones, but I'm hoping the voters at the Hall of Fame take note of that here at some point.
Do you think she kind of changed the face of fillies against colts? Because after that, when it kind of became more acceptable in American racing to do that, I think you might have been a little bit of a pioneer there.
I do think that probably had some effect on it for her to be able to do that. And, you know, I think Wayne, you know, showed with Winning Colors and Lady Secret a few times. But I think the main thing is that, you know, it takes those exceptional fillies and generally really strong fillies to be able to do that. And so, I think it sort of put it back in vogue anyways for that time frame.
Todd, was that your greatest training feat?
I don't know. I don't know how you can classify some of those things. I mean, I like I've said before, sometimes, you know, some of your maybe your best training feats go completely unnoticed because it could be by a horse with very little talent that actually goes on and does something to fulfill what talent he does or she does have, where, you know, maybe some really good ones you don't do as good a job with. But, I mean, I think just from winning a huge race and with the filly and all that, I think you could argue that it was right up there.
You know, let's focus on a little more recent history, Todd, because a lot was made this past year at the Belmont with Steve Asmussen getting his first Belmont Stakes victory with Creator, running down Destin, who you trained. very reminiscent of the battle that we saw with Rags to Riches and Curlin, albeit Creator came and got Destin right at the end. Is there something to be said? I mean, what's it like when the shoe's on the other foot like that, and you're the one that's a little bit more dejected after the race?
Oh man, that was an awfully tough beat, and it's also coming not too long after Commissioner got nailed by Tonalist and late, and Stay Thirsty got beat a half a length, and yeah, I mean, we Dunkirk led most of the way and got beat a length. I mean, we're probably a length or so away from having about four Belmont wins, but the Commissioner and the Destin ones were about as tough as it gets. So I mean, it's tough. I mean, those kind of losses can really be dejecting, and you know, you want to feel sorry for yourself, but at the end of the day, there's not a whole lot you can do other than get up the next morning and keep trying. But there's certain losses that I think you just kind of never truly get over, and I guess you tend to remember the heartbreaking photos that you lose, sometimes even more so than the lucky head bobs you get. But that was a tough one, and I think Quality Roads beating the Whitney was pretty tough when he lost to Blame, and certainly Uncle Mo coming back off the layoff and getting beat by Caleb's Posse and the King's Bishop. And some of those, you just, you know, as much as anything, you feel bad for the horse and the owners when you lose those heartbreaking ones. But the other side of it is, like I said, you know, if Rags to Riches would have got a beat a nose in addition to Commissioner and Dustin, it makes a big difference. So you got to appreciate the ones you do get.
Yeah, for me, that was a very interesting event, the winner's circle, and right after that race, because you and Steve Asmussen, you're guys that you don't really wear your heart on your sleeve. You're very, you know, relaxed, win or lose. You kind of have the same demeanor. But I'm standing there in the winner's circle. Steve Asmussen is jumping up and down like a banshee, you know, and you're walking that long walk down through the box seat section, and you kind of just shook your head ever so slightly, like, oh God, I can't believe it, you know. And and Steve's going crazy, and it was almost surreal for me to see that, because you're two men who really, you know, keep your cool under every circumstance. And I got one guy going nuts, and the other guy's really dejected, and it was a really different scenario.
Yeah, I mean, I can. You know, for Steve, it was I'm sure a huge win, and you know, just the way the race unfolded and kind of getting up that last jump made it all the more difficult for us, and I'm sure all the more exciting for them. So it was you know, Steve's a unbelievable trainer, and you know, so sometimes it's difficult to lose to anyone, but you know, when you lose to guys that put as much into the business as him and his team do, you know, I guess you can kind of walk away at least feeling good about that part of it.
Visiting with trainer Todd Pletcher here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Todd, let's focus on another moment, and we did touch on this in the first show back in 2012, but I want you to kind of look back on this moment again, if you would. Another career highlight for you, Super Saver, giving you your lone Kentucky Derby victory back in 2010. What a moment that was.
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, it was obviously the win we've been looking for to get the proverbial monkey off our back, and winning a Derby. It was funny because we went into the winter after he'd won the Kentucky Jockey Club in the fall at Churchill and ran so well. We knew he liked the surface there, and so we sort of went into the winter thinking that, you know, he had a legitimate chance at the Derby and hopefully getting there, and it just seemed like nothing was going really well for him for most of the winter. You know, we were just having trouble getting him into a groove, and he got sick, and it was just kind of one little thing after another, and finally we got a delayed start in the Tampa Derby, and I think you know, he ran well, but wasn't fully cranked up for that. And then we were planning on going probably to the Wood or the at the time. And then he got another little temperature, and so we had a setback for that. It just seemed like, you know, we were having trouble getting on schedule for it. And we ended up using the Arkansas Derby as a backup plan, and he lost a tough photo there. But it was just one of those things that everything seemed to start to go right for the horse in the 3 weeks after the Arkansas Derby. He came into himself. He was moving great, and loved Churchill and Breeze Super there, and just, you know, everything went for that 3 week period. Just everything came together. And you know, sometimes you'd love to be able to control those things with all of them. In some cases, it just happens, and it was perfect for him, and get a perfect trip and wet track, and all those things just kind of fell into place. And sometimes you need things to go your way a little bit and get a lucky break. And, you know, I think we got a few of them, you know, especially those last couple of weeks leading into it and with the wet track. And he was the best he had been at any point in his life at that time.
Todd Pletcher with us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, looking back on some of those memorable moments that we've seen over the years, and there have been so many for Todd and for his entire team. It's been quite a ride. We're going to continue to do that in the second half of the program. We're going to look back on some of the other names that it's kind of a trip down memory lane, so to speak, because we're going to look back on names like A Shadow and English Channel and Wait a While and Spitestown and even Flower Alley, some of those names that we grew up with in the sport that Todd has been part of. So should be a lot of fun, JT.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Todd, if you don't mind, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. We will come back. The second half of Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, is next. The heat is on. Fasig Tipton is now accepting nominations to the Gulfstream Selected 2-Year-Old in Training Sale. The Gulfstream Sale takes place March 1st, 2017 at Gulfstream Park with an under-tax show on February 27th. Having outperformed the market last year with massive gains over 2015, including an increased median of 92%, an increased average of 45%, and a top price of $1.8 million, the Gulfstream sale was the only sale that displayed a fully upward trajectory among the 7 juvenile sales hosted by North American auction companies. 6 buyers spent more than $1 million. 20 buyers spent $500,000 or more, and the top 11 hips in last year's sale were purchased by 10 unique entities and consigned by 9 unique entities. Nominate now. It's the Fasig Tipton Gulfstream Sale, March 1st, 2017 at Gulfstream Park.
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Russell Meyer, one of the names of the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm. Dedicated to the dream.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Stop charging, Maria. Far outside goes third. Wedding Toast now picks it up fourth. Stellar Wind angles wide in the fifth position. Carolina sixth. Sheer Drama seventh. Frivolous goes to the grandstand side in eighth. Got Lucky has a ways to come. Has to go very wide in the stretch. It's wide open. Stellar Wind, Stop Charging, Maria going at it for the top spot. Moving by the eighth pole. Yeah, Hillwood next. Calamity Kate toward the inside. Sheer Drama is fifth. Stop Charging, Maria, short lead. Stellar Wind is fighting on. Stop Charging, Maria just keeps battling back. Stop Charging, Maria
wins the Longines Breeders' Cup distaff for Javier Castellano in 1:48.45.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Jude Feld in our Lexington studios, continuing to visit with trainer Todd Pletcher about his stellar career. Stop Charging Maria, winning the Breeders' Cup distaff in 2015. Kurt Becker had the call. That was at Keeneland. And of course, winning for trainer Todd Pletcher. It was one of two Breeders' Cup victories for Todd on that program. Of course, he won the Dirt Mile in 2015 with Liam's Map. So it was an outstanding Breeders' Cup. And Todd, I can imagine that you couldn't have asked for anything better going into that one.
No, I mean, you know, the one thing we felt like we'd learned from the year before was that Stop Charging Maria ran very well when she was fresh. And so we decided not to run her after after Saratoga and just train her up to the Breeders' Cup. And I remember her last breeze prior to the Breeders' Cup was she was actually the last one that we were going to breeze prior to the Breeders' Cup. All the other horses had breezed the 2 days prior to that. And the forecast that morning was looking a little dicey, and we originally had her scheduled to breeze after the break, and it looked like rain was coming in, so we called an audible and decided to breeze her at like 5:30 in the morning. It's dark at Keeneland. It's much better than it used to be in the old days because they've got some lighting around there from the grandstand and stuff. But I remember clocking her, and she breezed really well, but the gallop out was like insane to the point where I thought I'd actually mistimed it, that she went so fast on the gallop out. And so I called Mike while she was clocking. I said, did you catch that the same way I did? And he's like, yeah, I sure did. So I knew she was sitting on a big race, and she's generally one of those that was so transparent. When she was going to run well, she would always breeze really well. So we were pretty excited coming up to the race, and it was great to see her deliver a performance like that.
Yeah, she was awesome. I might be a little prejudiced because my wife works for Town & Country Farm, but that was a big day for everybody, certainly for you and for the horse especially. She just ran as good as she could run.
Absolutely, yeah. And she was a terrific filly, and you know, just so genuine. And like I said, when you know, it's great when you have some of those for ended up, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 year old year, and you get to know them well enough that you can just kind of read when they're really on their games, and she was certainly giving us every indication that she was.
If you are just joining us here on Trainer Talk tonight, don't forget that if you miss any portion of the show, you can go back to our website, horseracingradio.net, and check out the podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows at your leisure, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Todd Pletcher joined us back in 2012 for a 30-minute visit, and we didn't get an opportunity that day to touch on some of his more memorable moments in his career, meaning some of the stars that he has been around on the equine side. So we're going to do that for you in the second half of the program this afternoon. And Todd, I thought what we would do, I'm going to kind of throw it to you and just throw you a name of one of those top horses you've been around and let you kind of fill us in on some of the thoughts that you have, some of the things that come to mind when I mention that name. And let's go ahead and start right in the beginning. Let's start with the name Jersey Girl.
I've always said that I felt like two horses really helped my career get going, and her and More Than Ready, I think are the two that really put us on the, you know, sort of a national scene, winning graded stakes, and she was our first grade one winner when she won the Acorn. But we bought her out of the Fasig Tipton Calder, that time 2-year-old training cell from Niall Brennan, for the Ackerley brothers for $220,000. And I mean, she was just an absolute gorgeous filly. Just, you know, everything that Wayne Lucas would teach you about what you want a horse to look like, she was that. Just a big, powerful, beautiful mare. And, you know, had some success as a 2-year-old, had to give her a little time off, but came back as a 3-year-old. And I think ended up going 7 for 7 and with wins in the Acorn and the Mother Goose and the Test. Just really got our stable going, and she's certainly an all-time favorite.
How about Trippy?
Trippy was an interesting horse. I tell you, he was extremely talented, very fast, and I guess to put it kindly, he was a bad mover. You know, he looked like, you're riding a washing machine when he would come at you, but man, he did it effectively and quickly. And I remember asking Jerry Bailey, who rode him a lot, I said, does this horse feel better than he looks? Because he goes, he does. He said, man, when he's going full speed, he feels awesome. And I mean, he delivered some big races, and we stretched him out to a mile and an eighth in the Flamingo, and I think at that point he was 3-for-3, and we went on to the Derby. But after the Derby, we backed him up, and you know, he became a world-class sprinter and really pretty good sire too, considering I think his career got cut a little bit short here when he was sold to South Africa. But you still see his name in some pedigrees, broodmare sire Liam's Map, and so he's a he was a really, really fast and high-quality horse.
Yeah, we kind of passed over Liam's Map when we talked about the Breeders' Cup, but that was one of the most impressive races of the day, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that we felt like was really important and tells you how sometimes I think you can overanalyze things and overthink and worry too much, but, you know, the only thing I told Javier Castellano in the paddock is just, you know, make sure you get out of the gate and make sure you don't get away slowly. And so naturally broke poorly and came away fifth or sixth with horses. And I was like, oh, no. But he delivered a big race, and he was just, he was too good. He was too good on the day, and I don't know. We had kicked around the idea of maybe trying the Breeders' Cup Classic with him, and who knows, he might have kept American Pharoah honest in there. But, we were kind of looking to do what we knew he did best, and we were happy to get a Breeders' Cup win for him.
Todd, you have so many riders like John Velasquez, like Javier Castellano, that are your go-to guys. They've been with you for a very long time. They know you, your horses, they know your program. What's your philosophy on giving them pre-race instruction?
I try to generally keep it pretty simple, and the thing I always try to emphasize to those guys is, you know, whatever we discuss pre-race and in the paddock, and you know, that's plan A, but I've got confidence in you guys to go to plan B and C and whatever that is. And you know, you can't always predict not only how your horse is going to get away from the gate or how they're going to be early on, but you also can't predict what the other guys in the race are going to do. So while on paper, you know, it might look like you're the lone speed, there might be four other guys in the race thinking that. So, you know, the main thing is we can talk about a plan. We can talk about maybe some idiosyncrasies that I think the horse may have, may want to be inside, outside, might like dirt in his face, some things, you know, maybe that we've picked up on in their training that they might not be aware of as the jockey. But, you know, at the end of the day, we got to have a game plan, but they also have to have, and I have to have the confidence in them to call an audible along the way. And, and those guys know that. And I try not to second guess riders too much. And I think day in, day out, if you use those guys, you're going to come out on the winning side in the long haul.
Let me throw another name at you that I came across as I was looking through the gazillion greatest stakes winners that you've trained in your career. Left Bank.
Yeah, I would say just in terms of sheer talent, as good as any horse we've trained, and certainly, you know, every once in a while you'll get that question, you know, who's the best horse you ever trained? And I honestly don't have an answer to that. But I can tell you there have been some horses that we've trained over the years that I think on a given day were capable of beating just about anyone. And I think he put in a couple of races that were good enough to do that. And he won the Tom Fool and ran 120 flat at Belmont. And when he won the Whitney and 147 flat at Saratoga, I mean, I think those performances would have matched up against just about anybody ever.
How about a name that people might have forgotten about? And I certainly did when I was flipping back through the roster of those greatest stakes winners. Balto Star. Tell me about Balto Star.
A really cool horse, and he's a Glitterman out of a Devil's Bag mare that we had purchased at a 2-year-old sale, and for Ann Stu Stables, who was one of my first supporters, and it's funny how I think sometimes you'd like to think that everything is so planned out in this business, and you really think everything through, but this filly, Miss Livy, who we had purchased, wasn't showing us a lot of talent, and she came up with a little bit of a suspensory issue that we felt like was going to take probably a minimum of 6 months to heal. So it was the most matter-of-fact conversation I had with Mr. Sabotnik at the time, and he said, "What would you do?" And I said, I would retire her and just go ahead and breed her. And so he said, "Okay." He called me back, I think, the next day and said, "Which one of these stallions do you prefer?" I've talked to my pedigree guy, and so he threw out three names, and I don't remember who the other two were, but I said, "I think I'd go to Glitterman." So the first foal was Balto Star, and he came out and bucked his shins in his first start at two, and then just really got good later in the fall, and turned out to be, just a really good horse, period. But went in the United Nations, I think, was certainly one of my funnest wins when he was able to go wire to wire there. And, he won the Spiral as a 3-year-old. I think probably holds the not-so-great achievement of going one of the – I think it was the fastest half mile in Derby history. And then Song and a Prayer hooked up in 44 and change. So that was probably not our greatest race strategy of all time. But, just a beautiful horse and a great horse to be around, and another one that stuck around for a while and just, was on a given day, he was awfully, awfully good.
Hearing you say that reminds me of a day. I was at Gulfstream Park. We were doing, I believe, maybe the Florida Derby, I don't know, but you won three Derby preps that day, and one was the Louisiana Derby. And I can't remember the horse's name, but you turned around and you kind of announced to the crowd, that was the slowest 2 minutes in sports. And I've never forgotten that. It was the guys with the lime green and brown silks.
Was it Circular Key? It
might have been Mission Impossible.
That's who it was, Mission Impossible. And it was just a really cool moment because you kind of like turned around and looked at the crowd and said, that was the slowest 2 minutes in sports. And everybody that was around there just cracked up and it was classic.
Yeah, I know that the stretch at the fairgrounds can be absolutely brutal. I remember thinking More Than Ready was home free in the Louisiana Derby and getting beat late, and it's just, man, it can if you're on the lead or you're close, you just never quite know where you are, and especially if you're watching it on TV, it's like this, where is the finish line?
Well, the finish line got there just in time that day for Mission Impossible, and Todd Pletcher was able to celebrate a very special day, a magical day, and he's had several of those in his career. Todd, how about when I say the name A Shadow, what comes to mind?
Just a remarkable filly, and she was our first Hall of Fame inductee, which was a lot of fun for us, and like I say, it's funny how little things when you're training a horse kind of stand out in your mind. And I mean, she had a lot of terrific victories but she did something that I thought was so impressive one day. This is when she first came in, and she was a little bit flighty about when you would put the rider up. So this would have been March of her 2-year-old year. She was one of the first 2-year-olds to come into us at Palmetto's. And we had a pretty good exercise rider for us getting on her at the time. And this was about her third or fourth day. But he got on her on the walking ring at Palmetto's, and she bucked and launched him what seemed like 50 feet in the air. And no harm was done to him or her, but it was one of the most athletic things I've seen a horse do. And it's just like, that is unbelievable. I don't know if she's going to be any good, but she's got some serious moves and some serious athletic ability to do that. And so it's funny, of all the things that she did, I'll never forget that in particular.
Yeah, that's quite a feat. Do you find that fillies like that are a little cranky, a little flighty, sometimes they're the better ones?
Yeah, it can be. I mean, I tell you, Rax for Riches was one of the toughest fillies to be around, and not once you got her out of the stall, but in the stall she was very territorial and downright mean at times. And you know, she'd be one of those, if you were just walking around the barn checking on the horses and kind of stick your head into the stall to check the feed tub, that kind of thing, you better be ready, because if she was coming from the back of the stall to get you, and she was a tough filly that way. But once you got her outside the stall, she was absolutely just gentle and easy to train, a beautiful filly to gallop. But I do think there's definitely some attitude to some of the better fillies that you know, I've been around, and even back to the days with Wayne, with Serena Song and Winning Colors and some of those fillies, they were tough fillies, and I think it's part of what made them good.
Well, there's another filly I need to ask you about, and she was a champion for you. That's Wait a While. What's her story?
Very, very gifted filly, very, very good on all surfaces, really. Turned out to be special on the turf. And another one that kind of had a little bit of a quirk. She was funny around the gate, and we ended up midway through her three-year-old year actually entering her in the gate with a blindfold on, and that seemed to take away all the anxiousness for her. But she was difficult to load at times, but very explosive turn of foot, and you know, basically was able to win champion three-year-old off of large part of a successful grass season, and winning the yellow ribbon as a three-year-old, and great filly, and a lot of fun for us, because Michael McCarthy was working for me at the time, and one of his jobs for the winter was to go over and clock horses at Calder in the two-year-old training cell, and this was actually the OBS cell, I think, in February, and so we had our eye on this filly. She wasn't like an oil painting in terms of to look at, but I remember when we were clocking her during the Breeze show, she galloped out in 46 and change, and this was kind of early on in the two-year-old season, I think, before the consigners were really emphasizing the gallop outs, and so that's kind of what sold us on her, and you know, we didn't project she'd turn out to be such a great turf filly, but we knew she had some talent based on that.
Yeah, you like to buy a lot of two-year-olds in training. Is that the key, the workouts?
You know, I think it's always evolving. And like I said, early on, I think before people were really breezing their horses and knowing that people were clocking the gallop outs and emphasizing the gallop outs, I thought that was sort of an angle you could have that maybe not everybody else was on. And I think once more of the buyers caught onto that, then more of the consigners caught onto the fact that the buyers are on it. And so now that, you know, the eighth of a mile breezes are really three eighths of a mile or a half. So I think it's a little harder to kind of find that hidden gem now as it maybe was back then. But I do think you can spot the runners there, and you know, it's definitely, I'm not saying it's a higher percentage of success rate, because there's negative sides to it as well, but I do like that you get to see a horse move over the track and see how they're handling the pressure of training and those kind of things. But you know, if I were recommending to a new person in the business, how do you attack the game? I don't think there's a simple answer. I think you try to do it from all angles, and you know, buy some yearlings and buy some two-year-olds in training and breed some and buy some horses that have already run. I don't think there's one method that's proven to be better than the other ones over the long haul.
Enjoying this trip down memory lane with trainer Todd Pletcher here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on HRN. Todd, I'm going to ask you about a horse that was one of my favorites, and that's English Channel. Tell me a little bit about English Channel.
Yeah, it's funny. The morning of the Pegasus, or morning before the Pegasus, my dad was down, and Frank Brothers, who works with Starlight and buys a lot of their horses, was kidding my dad, who picked out English Channel as a yearling for $50,000. and said, you know, how could you possibly have loved, you know, bought this horse the way he looked? He was kind of small and thin. And I remember my dad telling me in December when he was breaking the horse that he thought a really, really nice smart strike colt. And I was in Ocala for Christmas and walking around the barn, and I remember seeing him in the stall, and he had bought him at the Keeneland September sale after I'd already left and gone back to Belmont. And I said, this is the colt you like, you know, he's pretty small, isn't he? And he said, I'm telling you, this is a nice horse. And he turned out to be right. I mean, just unbelievable turf career, and to win the United Nations twice and the Breeders' Cup at Monmouth for Jim Scaturcio, and, you know, literally lives around the corner from Monmouth. It was just one of those too-good-to-be-true stories, you know, and then to turn out to be a really solid stallion and sire of a Travers winner. He just unbelievable horse, and just a remarkable career.
You're a very good turf trainer, but you don't have a lot of turf horses. Is that because the focus of your operation, your client's focus, is on the Triple Crown?
Well, I think that's part of it. And, you know, I mean, for the most part, we will buy some turf horses. But, I believe that the commercial markets, you know, especially in America, supports dirt horses. And we've always felt like that's our first goal is to produce, hopefully, stallion prospects. And generally, that's going to be done on the dirt. But when we do have that fallback plan on the grass, I think we can get the job done. But, you know, it's not generally our primary focus. But I found that over the years, really, that training turf horses is a lot of times a little bit easier than dirt horses. I don't think you have to do quite as much with them. And if you can get them to turn off and finish, then that's a big part of it. But, you know, you also have to be a little bit careful, hopefully, that you identify early enough on when you're trying to develop some dirt horses that they're not dirt horses, that they're turf horses, and you can kind of alter their training a little bit because, you know, a lot of successful dirt runners, you gotta get involved in the race, and you want to be part of the action early and on the bridle and some speed in their mind. And it's not always the case with turf horses, so you got to train them a little bit differently and identify what they want to do, you know, is a big part, I think, of having success as a trainer.
Well, there was no question about the surface that Lawyer Ron was going to prefer, Todd. He excelled on the dirt. He was absolutely exceptional for the majority of his career. Tell me a little bit about Lawyer Ron and being around him.
Yeah, similar to what we were talking about with Left Bank early, I think there were some performances in his career that were just absolutely unbelievable. And the Whitney in 146-3, which is track record at Saratoga, and I don't think anyone had ever run a sub 147 mile and an eighth in the 50 year plus history of Saratoga. So he was unbelievable that day, and just a, you know, really, really talented horse that had that true American dirt style where you couldn't let him go and you couldn't go with him and just kind of run you off your feet. And it was a fun horse for us. We didn't get him till a little later on, but it's certainly some of the races that he was able to put in and then be champion older horse was fun.
You know, one thing that your average fan might not realize about trainers is that they oftentimes become very attached to their horses, especially the very good ones, but they don't even have to be among their champions. They become very attached to them and they follow their careers afterwards, whether they go to stud or to a retirement facility, whatever it might be. And Lawyer Ron ended up having to be euthanized at age 6 after colic surgery, after he was already retired. For a trainer to get that kind of news, Todd, about a horse that was so special to their operation, how difficult is that when you hear of those types of things?
Yeah, I mean, it was so disappointing because, I think in retrospect, too, and the limited data, the limited number of babies that he was able to get, I think he was actually going to be a really, really good stallion. And it's so disheartening, you know, when you have a horse have a, you know, a sustained career like he did and then get off to a good start at stud. And it really does. It bothers you and it hurts you. And, you know, sometimes it can be emotional when you hear about stuff like that. So, I guess it's part of the business, and it's a difficult part, but you just try to hold on to the good times and think back about all the fun that you had when you did train them. But you just, for me, it's disappointing when you don't get to see a horse get to fulfill their true potential. And even though they've seen it through all the way through their racing career, there's that second career at stud that can. They can be more important and certainly have a longer lasting influence on the business. And I think he was in a position to do that.
Is there any horse that's like your favorite or one that you think you did an exceptional job with, even if it's that 12-5 claimer you talked about?
No, I'd say I've probably done a bad job with more of them than I have a good job. I mean, the ones that you guys are mentioning are the easy ones to remember and be proud of, and certainly we're exciting. I think I was thinking back, we were talking about More Than Ready and the success he's had and the longevity of his stallion career, but someone was asking me not too long ago, who's the best 2-year-old you ever trained, and I said, well, I think it depends on what part of the year you break it down into, because I think Uncle Mo was arguably as good a 2-year-old as there's ever been, even though he only ran 3 times to break his maiden by 16 plus lengths at Saratoga and then win the Champaign and fastest Breeders' Cup and, whatever historical speed figures you look at, I would stack his up against anyone's. But when you look at More Than Ready and what he did, before August 1st of his 2-year-old year, he broke his maiden at Keeneland. He won the WHAS at Churchill. He won the Flash at Belmont. He won the Tremont at Belmont. He won the Sanford at Belmont. You don't see 2-year-olds run that many times, ever anymore, hardly. And for him to do all that before August 1st is, he was just so precocious and so intelligent and so fast that, he had a remarkable career in those 3 months before August.
Todd, only about a minute or so left before we have to start wrapping up the program, but one thing I want to go back to is something you mentioned in that first show when you joined us back in 2012 on Trainer Talk, and you talked about the consistent work ethic and commitment to the profession that it takes to be successful. You've obviously displayed that throughout your entire career. I'm curious, though, with all the wins, all the accolades, the awards that you've been presented, all the big races you've won, what is it that's still motivating and driving Todd Pletcher?
Well, I think the toughest part about this game is that no matter how well you're doing, if you're doing exceptionally well, you're still losing 70% of the time. And, there's always bigger races to win and goals that you haven't achieved. And, we haven't won a Breeders' Cup Classic and we haven't won a Preakness. And, so there's always things you think you can improve upon, and there's constantly new challenges every day, and part of it is trying to just continue to improve, and there's always a new crop of 2-year-olds coming in, so there's that excitement and just wanting to continue to do well and do better, and I think that's how everyone should approach every day.
Well, here's to hoping that all of those goals are achieved here in 2017. Todd, as always, really, really appreciate the time. I know you got a lot on your plate, so anytime you can join us, it's a pleasure and a privilege. Thank you so much, and all the best going forward.
Thanks very much, guys. Appreciate it.
And Todd Pletcher on Trainer Talk, like all of our guests who appear on the program, receives a gift courtesy of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. We'll send those out to Todd, and boy, what an hour.
Yeah, that was fantastic.
Yeah, tremendous. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast of this program on our website, horseracingradio.net, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes, and join us every single Wednesday for Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. For our producer, Lee Delapina, for Jude Feld, and for our guest, Todd Pletcher, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening.